Your mother has asked me to remove you from the family's car insurance policy. Effective immediately, you will need to secure your own coverage. Please do not drive until you have done so. Indignation burned hot in my veins. Who just cuts off their own daughter's ability to drive without so much as a heads up? Then I realized that I had a much bigger problem on my hands. The title to my car. It's still at the house. And if I want to get my own insurance, I need that damn piece of paper in my name. The thought of having to face Ruby, of having to beg and plead for what was rightfully mine, made my skin crawl. But I had no choice. Time to gravel. I typed out a message, my words carefully chosen and painfully polite. I brought our congregation president, Jim Nelson, into the text conversation as a form of emotional backup. I knew Ruby would be less likely to ignore the text if someone powerful was included. "Mom, I'm going to get my own car insurance, and I would like the title of the car as proof of ownership. Is there a way I can get this from you?" I hit send and waited, my heart pounding in my chest. And then, after what felt like an eternity, her response came through. "Sherry, this is just another example of your lying and manipulating, bringing President Jim Nelson into this text thread. You were just asking for the title for your car, which I have no problem getting to you. You could have just asked me. You've been very active in deceiving and creating chaos, pain, destruction, and turmoil. My own daughter has turned on truth and me, and the outcomes are devastating to your siblings. Sherry, I am your mother. I am only guilty of teaching you truth. Truth is the only thing that matters in this life, and you have fought against it since you were little. It breaks my heart you are at war with God. The Lord has blessed you with a quick mind, and it is devastating to watch you use that mind to fight against truth. I will give the title to Pam. Feel free to collect it from her." I texted Pam, my words carefully neutral and polite. How did one even begin a conversation like this, a negotiation with a gatekeeper? "Hi, Pam. Ruby mentioned that she would be leaving some documents with you for me to pick up. Is there a convenient time for me to come by and collect them? Thanks, Sherry." Her response came quickly, setting a date and time the following week when I should come by. That was easy, I thought, feeling a little better. I can just swing by, grab my documents, and be done with this whole mess. But a couple of things happened before I was able to get my car title back. The situation at home had escalated. With Kevin gone and Ruby increasingly absent, I felt a growing sense of dread about my younger siblings' welfare. The final straw came when a neighbor informed me that the children had been left alone for 5 days while Ruby was off doing God knows what with Jody. I was stunned. 5 days. No adult supervision. No one to make sure they were fed, safe, looked after. The thought of my younger siblings fending for themselves for nearly a week made my blood boil. In that moment, I knew I had to do something. Consequences be damned. I made a call to the Division of Child and Family Services, DCFS, requesting a welfare check on the children. The police went to the house, knocked on the door, and looked inside the windows. They reported back that the kids were there, and apparently everyone was fine. I was relieved they were okay, but frustrated at the lack of action. While there might not be specific laws against leaving minors alone, surely 5 days crossed some kind of line. My relief was short-lived. Somehow, Ruby had discovered that I was the one who called DCFS, and now she was on the warpath. I don't know how she figured it out, but she wanted my head on a stick. Now, I found myself in the awkward position of having to face Pam to collect my car title, all while knowing about Ruby's fury, as if things weren't awkward enough already. I paced back and forth across the Haymans' living room, probably wearing a hole in their carpet as my brain went into overdrive, conjuring up all sorts of nightmare scenarios. What if Pam straight up refuses to give me the title? What if she tries to use it as a bargaining chip to force me back under Ruby's thumb? Panicking, I fired off a text to Pam, hoping and praying that Ruby had been too embarrassed to tell her what had happened. "Hey, Pam, I'm really anxious to get those documents. Would it be possible for you to just leave them in your mailbox for me to pick up? I'm kind of in a rush today. Thanks again, Sherry." Her response was swift and unequivocal. "Absolutely not, Sherry. These are valuable legal documents, and I won't risk them being stolen or lost. You'll need to come to the house and collect them in person. See you at the appointed time and day." Pam. As if the situation wasn't stressful enough, a few days before I was supposed to go and pick up the documents, Reddit exploded. Word had gotten out that Kevin and Chad were no longer living at home, and the internet, with its insatiable appetite for our family drama, had latched onto this information. Rumors were spreading, theories were being formed on Reddit and other forums about what was going on, questioning my role in everything. In the face of this growing speculation, I felt compelled to make my position clear and posted an Instagram story. I know that there are many rumors circulating online about my family. While it is true I am not in contact with my immediate family and don't support the extreme beliefs of connections, please remember that this is my real family. Despite good intentions, speculating, rumors, and gossip doesn't help us. I'd like to ask for privacy for me and my family as we work through this very difficult situation. Please know that many are working on this situation, and I hope one day we can be whole again. Please respect my privacy as I work on my own healing as well. I knew that by posting this statement, I was effectively burning whatever flimsy bridge might have remained between me and Ruby. But something inside me had shifted. The need to stand up for what I believed in, to distance myself from Ruby and Jody and all they represented, had become stronger than my fear of the consequences. As I posted it, I felt a mix of terror and exhilaration. It was as if I jumped off a cliff, not knowing if there was water or rocks below. But for the first time in a long time, I felt like I was being true to myself. Whatever came next, I would face it. My heart was racing as I approached Mrs. Haymond in the kitchen. The words felt heavy in my mouth, but I forced them out. "Mrs. Haymond," I said, my voice small and shaky, "I have to go pick up some documents from Pam today. Would you maybe come with me? I don't think I can do it alone, and I'm not supposed to drive without insurance." Mrs. Haymond's face softened, her eyes filling with a compassion I'd grown to rely on. "Of course I'll come with you, Sherry. We'll do this together." The drive to Pam's house was a blur. As we walked up the front steps, each footfall felt like it was bringing me closer to some inevitable confrontation. My hand trembled as I knocked on the door. When it swung open, my worst fears were confirmed. There stood Pam, her face pinched with disapproval. But it was the figure behind her that made my blood run cold. Ruby, my mother, stood tall and regal, my documents clutched in her hand like a hostage. It was an ambush. "Hello, Sherry," Ruby said, her voice dripping with false sweetness. I swallowed hard, my mouth suddenly dry as sandpaper. "Can I please have my papers?" I asked, holding out my hand, willing it not to shake. Ruby's eyes narrowed. "Not so fast. I'm not giving you the title until you listen to what I have to say. Come inside. Let's have a little chat." In that moment, I felt a surge of strength I didn't know I possessed. "No," I said, my voice trembling but clear. "I'm not coming inside. If you want to talk, we can do it out here." And so, there we stood, the four of us, on Pam's front porch, locked in a bizarre standoff. Ruby, clutching my documents like a weapon. Pam, hovering like a shadow. Mrs. Haymond, calm and unflappable behind me, a silent pillar of support. And me, shaking like a leaf, but refusing to back down. Ruby's face contorted with anger and hurt. "I can't believe you called the police on me," she began, her voice rising. "After everything I've done for you, after all the sacrifices I've made, how could you betray me like that, Sherry? How could you be so selfish?" I could feel Mrs. Haymond's steady presence behind me, reminding me that I wasn't alone, that I had support beyond the toxic web of my family. "Selfish?" I repeated, finding strength in my voice. "I was worried about the kids. They were alone for 5 days, Mom. 5 days. "They're fine," Ruby snapped. "They're old enough to take care of themselves. This is about you, Sherry. Your jealousy, your need for attention." I felt a bubble of hysterical laughter rise in my throat. How could she twist this around, make it about me? But then, wasn't that always her way? "This isn't about me," I said, my voice steadier than I felt. "It's about the safety of my siblings. It's about doing what's right." Ruby's eyes flashed dangerously. "What's right? You have no idea what's right. You're just a child playing at being an adult. Your siblings are terrified of you now for calling the police on them." Ruby's face hardened, her lips twisting into a sneer. "One day, Sherry, you'll come crawling back to me, begging for my forgiveness. and it'll be hard for me to give it to you, but I'll be gracious. Forgiveness for what, Mom? You're telling lies about me everywhere, and they're spreading like dandelion seeds across the field. The weeds are all going to pop up, and one day you'll have to go back and cut them all down and come apologize to me. I'm not going to apologize for telling the truth, I said, my voice quiet but firm. How dare you contact Chad and Kevin behind my back, she hissed, spittle flying from her lips. They're my family too. You don't get to dictate who I can and can't talk to. I could feel my anger rising, hot and fierce in my chest. Ruby let out a harsh, mirthless laugh. Family? Please, you've made it abundantly clear that you want nothing to do with this family. You're a traitor, Sherry, a Judas in our midst. I could feel the tears streaming down my face, hot and sticky on my cheeks. You've always hated me, she whispered. Ever since you were 5 years old, I could see it in your eyes. The way you looked at me, the way you judged me. You've never appreciated anything I've done for you, all the sacrifices I've made. That's not true, I choked. I never hated you, Mom. I was just scared of you. Ruby shook her head. You're like the Romans in the Bible, she said, feeding me vinegar when I'm dying of thirst, crucifying me for your own selfish gains. I heard Mrs. Heyman mutter something under her breath, something that sounded suspiciously like, oh, for goodness sake. But I was too focused on Ruby to pay much attention. I could feel a panic attack coming on, my chest tightening and my vision starting to blur. Ruby wasn't finished. When you're ready to apologize, really apologize, then maybe we can be a family again, she said to me. But until then, don't contact me or Kevin or Chad or anyone else in our family, because you won't get a response. Mrs. Heyman stepped forward, her voice calm but firm. Ruby, I think it's time for you to give Sherry her documents and let us be on our way. For a moment, I thought Ruby might argue, might lash out with another barrage. But something in Mrs. Heyman's eyes, in the set of her jaw, must have given her pause. Ruby thrust the papers into my hands, her fingers brushing against mine. Here, she said, her voice cold and distant. I clutched the documents to my chest. One last thing, Ruby said. I saw your Instagram story. Can you promise to not talk about this anymore on social media? I waited until I had the paper safely in my bag before I responded, my voice shaking but clear. No, I said. And that was the last interaction I ever had with my mother. Mrs. Heyman guided me back to the car, her arm wrapped securely around my waist as if she could sense the weakness in my legs. As I collapsed into the passenger seat, the dam finally broke. My whole body shook and I began gasping for air. Mrs. Heyman didn't say a word, just put the car in gear and drove, her hands white-knuckled on the steering wheel. The houses and trees and mailboxes blurred together in a haze. I was excommunicated, disowned. It was a pain beyond words, a loss so profound that it felt like a physical amputation, like a part of my very soul had been ripped away. Mrs. Heyman's hand found mine across the center console, warm and reassuring. She didn't try to fill the silence with platitudes or empty reassurances, didn't try to minimize the enormity of what had just happened. She just held my hand, a silent promise that she would be there, her fingers wound tight around mine. Part 5. Fall of the Damned. Chapter 38. The Echo Chamber. Journal. I had a dream last night where I sat my youngest sister on my knee and explained why I couldn't talk with the family for now. I told her I loved her and asked her to come find me one day. I woke up and had the feeling she had the same dream as me. I feel she's being guided. Today also happens to be Dad's birthday. I sent him a text message and didn't expect a reply, but it still hurts that he didn't. I miss having someone to call Mom and Dad. It was endearing to my heart, and now all that's gone. My Instagram story had set off a firestorm of gossip, with people from all corners chiming in with their opinions and theories. I always knew there was something off about that family. Poor Sherry, I wonder what happened to make her turn her back on Ruby. I read the comments, the DMs, the texts from well-meaning strangers. If only they knew the full story of what's happened to my family, I thought, heartbroken. I took comfort in the sanctuary of the Heyman's home. The Haymans, who had shown me a different way of being, a different kind of care than any I had ever known before. It was a care that didn't come with strings attached, that didn't require me to twist myself into knots trying to earn it. It was a care that was freely given, without reservation or expectation. One day, I sat with the Haymans in the cozy living room of their home, the words tumbling out of my mouth before I could stop them. "May I call you Mom and Dad?" I asked, my cheeks burning. Mrs. Haymans' face lit up like a Christmas tree, her eyes glistening. "Oh, sweetheart," she breathed, pulling me into a tight hug that nearly crushed my ribcage. "Of course you can. I would be honored for you to call me Mom." I needed them and the stability they represented. I needed people who behaved like real family if I was ever going to get through this. "Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Ruby Frankie," my mother said brightly. "Welcome to another episode of the Connections Podcast, where we help you create joy in your life and relationships. Start your training today at connectionsclassroom.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Connections Coaching, or join our private Facebook group, Moms of Truth, with Jody and Ruby. Despite everything, Ruby and Jody were pushing on with their obnoxious Moms of Truth crusade, seemingly oblivious to the fact that the whole world was turning against them. To be accepted to the Moms of Truth Facebook group, you had to answer questions like, are you willing to be grateful to receive parenting advice from experienced women? Still, even with the screening, most of the women on that page were secret trolls, oddly fascinated by Ruby's narcissism and cruelty on 8 passengers, curious to see what the hell she was up to now. Pass the popcorn. A child is responsible for 3 things, Ruby preached. A child needs to learn to manage their thoughts, their feelings, and their behaviors. And they need to learn to manage them in truth, which means they're going to be honest, they're going to be responsible, and they're going to be humble with all of that. And that is a lot of responsibility. The sheer hypocrisy was staggering. Ruby and Jody had crowned themselves the ultimate authorities on motherhood and family, yet their actions spoke volumes about their true nature. Jody, estranged from both her son and daughter, had no contact with her own children. Ruby, who had cut me off entirely, was now hiding my siblings from the world, their lives shrouded in secrecy and isolation. The internet was ablaze with reactions, particularly on Reddit, where former 8 Passengers fans expressed their shock and disgust at Ruby's trajectory. These women are absolutely insane. The levels of absolute mental gymnastics they do is appalling. Ruby gaslights so much, beyond sanctimonious. But Ruby seemed oblivious to the outcry. She had retreated into an echo chamber of her own making, severing ties with everyone who might challenge her worldview. She had found her role as Jody's devoted disciple, and it seemed nothing could shake her from it. Jody never explicitly declared herself a prophet or deity, but the implication hung heavy in every word and action. She had positioned herself as the chosen one, a savior sent to lead the faithful to enlightenment. Ruby, in turn, had become her most fervent follower. Together, they presented themselves as all-knowing and all-powerful, allowing no challenge to their authority. My phone buzzed constantly with messages from concerned friends and even strangers. How are your siblings? Are they okay? Are you talking to them? I didn't know how to answer. My siblings, once so close, had become strangers to me. I had no idea about their well-being, their daily lives, or even their whereabouts. No one knew how they were doing. No one except Ruby. She was the gatekeeper, controlling all information about my siblings' lives. I couldn't provide the answers people were looking for, and I couldn't ease their concerns, or my own. I had to face the reality of our situation. A family fractured, siblings hidden away, and a mother who had chosen delusion over her children's well-being. Chapter 39, Abandoned by Justice. The knot in my stomach tightened with each passing day. I was back at school and couldn't stop pacing around my apartment, my thoughts spiraling with worry about my siblings. Everything was pointing to the fact that they were in serious trouble under Ruby's roof. The phone startled me out of my frantic thoughts. I glanced at the caller ID, our neighbor, Mrs. Larson. With a sense of dread, I answered. "Sherry, I thought you should know," Mrs. Larson said, her voice heavy. Ruby pulled all the kids out of school. I felt like I'd been sucker punched. Oh no. Thanks for letting me know, I managed before hanging up. I slumped into a chair, my head spinning. Then the phone rang again. This time, it was the Gundersons from across the street. Sherry, I hate to be the one to tell you this, Mr. Gunderson said apologetically, but your mom got rid of Dwight. What? No, I cried out. Our goofy, lovable Cavapoo. The kids were crazy about him. Why would she do that? I think, Mr. Gunderson hesitated. I think it's so the kids can't go out, you know, to walk him around the neighborhood. Seems like Ruby doesn't want them seeing anyone. The question was, what else was she doing to them? The possibilities made my head spin. I had to do something, but what? Call the cops again? Barge over there and confront Ruby myself? A crazy idea pushed its way into my head. What if I went crawling back to Ruby? Pretended to apologize, play nice, so I could be around the kids again? No, she wouldn't fall for it. I can't handle this on my own. I need backup, someone with real authority. I grabbed my phone, scrolling until I found the entry for DCFS, then punched the call button. DCFS, Kelly speaking. Hey, Kelly, it's Sherry Frankie. Remember me? We need to talk. I have new information on my siblings, and it's really bad. I need you to help us, please, before something awful happens. The next few weeks were a blur of DCFS agents, lawyers. They even talked about bringing a forensic psychologist on board. I recounted my own childhood abuse, every detail I could remember about my childhood with Ruby, my concerns that her cruel methods of psychological punishment and deprivation had worsened, and that the kids were now in significant danger. I talked until my throat was raw, begging them to step in before it was too late. The forensic psychologist believes there is significant evidence of emotional abuse, the DCFS caseworker told me, her voice reassuring. We have no evidence of physical abuse, but we're going to do everything possible to get this in front of a judge and get those kids the hell out of there. For the first time in forever, I felt a tiny spark of hope. Maybe, finally, someone with power would open their eyes and see what was happening. I prayed my heart out every day for those kids to hang on until the right people could gather the evidence they needed and finally take action. That little flicker of hope was snuffed out by a phone call I received about a month and a half later, on October 27th, 2022. Sherry, I'm so sorry. It was Kelly. She sounded upset. We're closing the case. The DA claims there's not enough hard evidence. Without real concrete proof the abuse is happening, our hands are tied. It's all conjecture. It's this new law. It's making things so hard for us to investigate cases of neglect. I'm so sorry. The phone fell from my hand, clattering to the floor. I collapsed against the wall as sobs overtook my body, sliding down until I was curled up on the floor. Hot tears streamed down my face. Heavenly Father, I pleaded desperately in between shuddering breaths, please help my family. Send us a lifeline in the form of your light. Chapter 40. Mommy's Mausoleum. What is pain? Is it wrong? Is it something to be avoided? No. Pain is an opportunity for growth. It is a place where you can gain wisdom about your experience, and it is an opportunity to grow. Have you ever heard the saying, no pain, no gain in the gym? That's what pain is for. It's an opportunity to develop, to stretch, to motivate yourself. Pain is a place where you can gain wisdom. So, the reality about pain is it's necessary. It is a gift. Jody Hildebrandt, Connections Classroom. The crisp November air nipped at my cheeks as I walked on campus. Out of nowhere, a familiar face jumped out at me. Professor Kevin Frankie, my father. For the past year, he'd managed to steer clear of me, even though he was still teaching at BYU. We'd been like two ghosts, haunting the edges of each other's lives. But now, bam, there he was, right in front of me. I'd played out this moment in my head a million times, trying to predict how it would feel, but it still knocked the wind out of me. Our eyes locked for a split second. He looked like hell warmed over. He shot me a strained, fake smile, then darted his gaze away, walking faster like he couldn't get away from me quick enough. Not a single word, just that pathetic little grimace. I wanted to run after him, grab him by the shoulders, and yell in his face. Are you blind? Where are your kids? Don't you care? But I just stood there, frozen. Who was I kidding? He could barely keep himself afloat, let alone throw a lifeline to his drowning children. Let it go, I thought. He's not capable of helping. On December 5th, my phone buzzed with a call from our neighbor. Sherry, I thought you should know, she said hesitantly. Your mother is packing up the house. I think she's moving. Dread clenched its fist around my heart. What? Where? Did she say anything to you? Well, she did ask about how much the HOA fees are, said she was thinking of renting out the house or selling it. I know she's been putting belongings and furniture up online for sale. I thanked her and hung up, my mind spinning. Was she moving her and the kids into Jody's house and Ivan's? I didn't know a soul in Jody's neck of the woods. There'd be no one to keep an eye out, to pass on intel about how the kids were holding up. Or even worse, what if they had something else in mind? What if they just up and vanished with the kids? Fell off the grid completely? Disappeared? This can't be happening. I can't lose them. I can't. My hands started shaking uncontrollably. I clenched them into fists, digging my nails into my palms, trying to ground myself. Breathe, Sherry. Just breathe. Panic rose in my throat. I felt like I needed to go to the house. I couldn't let her throw it all away. Everything from my childhood, every precious memento and keepsake was still in that house. My tiny treasures from our family trips, the scriptures Ruby and Kevin had given me when I was baptized, pieces of a life that had become a distant, rapidly fading dream. I couldn't let her erase me completely. I needed something, anything to hold on to, some scrap of proof that I'd existed. I composed an email to Ruby, fighting to keep my tone neutral. I explained that I'd like to come retrieve a few of my things, if possible. I held my breath and hit send, hoping against hope for a civilized response. The days ticked by with no reply. The silence was deafening, mocking. Of course. Why would Ruby make anything easy? Finally, I couldn't take it anymore. Dad, I need your help, I said to Mr. Haymond. I have to go to the house in Springville and get a few of my things before it's too late. Will you come with me? I don't think I can do this alone. You aren't alone, Sherry, he said. I'll go with you and we'll get your things. The next day, we rolled up to the curb outside the house I'd grown up in. Ruby's car was MIA, thankfully. The place looked dead, all the curtains yanked shut. If the kids were home, I knew Ruby would have instructed them not to answer any knock at the door, which was locked. And I was sure they'd been told not to talk to me, especially. I was the bad guy. So I marched around back, Dwight's old doggy door. It was a tight squeeze, but I managed to wriggle through, crash landing on the kitchen floor in a graceless heap. Ow. Okay. I'm in. I looked around. It seemed like nobody was home. A few boxes confirmed what Mrs. Gunderson had said, that Ruby was packing up. I ascended the stairs to my bedroom. The house was so quiet. I grabbed as much as I could in just a few short minutes. As I gathered my things, a random thought came. My parents' wedding anniversary was just around the corner. It would have been 22 years. As I sat there, clutching my measly little bag of memories, I wept. For the family I lost, for the black hole that had swallowed up my past. Happy anniversary, Ruby and Kevin. Hope it was worth it. Chapter 41. Nobody's Daughter. Journal. I feel like an orphan, like I'm nobody's daughter. But I know that I am his. I belong to Jesus Christ. Not even Jody can change that. In the midst of my sadness, a thought came to me. Why not reach out to my aunts? I'd never been especially close to any of them, but they were still my family, and they'd never done anything bad to me. As if the universe had heard my silent plea, that very day, my Aunt Julie reached out to me on Instagram. Her message was simple, yet it felt like a lifeline. Hey, we just moved to Provo, not far from you. Just want you to know, we think about you all the time. My heart raced as I read the rest of her message. She said she had heard about my situation, about how I'd been cut off, and she hoped I was okay. She asked if I would be interested in having dinner sometime. I replied, my fingers shaking slightly as I typed, I'd actually love to have dinner with you. A flurry of activity followed. Julie told Bonnie and Ellie, and before I knew it, Ellie was driving the 4 hours up from St. George, where she lived, for a big dinner at Julie's house. Ruby's three sisters and me. I approached Julie's house that evening, just 2 minutes away from my apartment, feeling a mix of excitement and apprehension. This dinner was complicated. I hadn't seen them in years. And yes, they had questions, so many questions. What's going on with Ruby? What about Jody? How are the kids? It felt like I was being grilled, but I understood their desperate need for information. They, too, were estranged from Ruby at this point, caught in the same web of family dysfunction that had ensnared me. The dinner, intense as it was also grounding. Here, finally, was some semblance of family. It wasn't perfect, it wasn't what I had lost, but it was something. A tether to my past, a possible bridge to my future. In the weeks that followed, Aunt Julie and I grew closer. When I was around her, I felt some sense of peace wash over me, a new kind of kinship. One forged in shared pain, mutual understanding, and the tentative hope for healing. Sometimes, family isn't just what you're born into. It's also what you build in the aftermath of loss. The glow of the television cast an eerie light across the darkened living room, the only sound the low murmur of the narrator's voice. I was curled up on the couch in my shared apartment, my eyes glued to the TV screen as another true crime show played out before me and my roomies. Lately, I couldn't seem to watch anything else. It wasn't just morbid fascination. I think some part of me was searching for answers. The story unfolding in front of me was chilling. A woman trapped in a relationship with a controlling, obsessive man. As the narrator described the way he isolated her, stalked her, followed her every move, my skin crawled with a sickening sense of recognition. I thought about the way Derek would look at me as he demanded to know where I'd been, who I'd been with, the constant barrage of texts and calls, the way he always guilt-tripped me over the smallest things. And then there were the strange, unsettling things he'd say to me. Like that one thing he said that I couldn't get out of my head. "You need to learn to defend yourself if ever you're in a bad situation, Sherry. I'll teach you how." A sense of unease settled in the pit of my stomach. "Really?" A slow smile spread across his face. "I'll just show up at your college campus, disguised, and I'll attack you, just to see if you've been paying attention." "What?" "Yeah, just to make sure that you're prepared and know how to react." He'd said it so nonchalantly, as though it wasn't a threat. But it was. I knew it was. It was him reminding me that at any given moment, he could do whatever he wanted with me, and I'd be powerless to stop him. My phone buzzed. I glanced down, my heart sinking as I saw the text from Derek. "I know everyone in your life has let you down, Sherry. You've been disappointed by a lot of people, hurt. But I'm here for you. I am one of the few that actually cares." I set my phone down and turned it to silent. On the screen, the true crime show was reaching its horrific climax. The ex-boyfriend, unable to accept that his love had moved on, had killed her. Police photos of the woman's lifeless body flashed across the screen, and suddenly I thought, I need my father. I wished I could have called Kevin, told him what was happening, asked for his help as my protector. He was right there, every day, teaching on the university campus. But it was as if I was invisible. My dad, still the man who had held me as a baby, who had taught me how to ride a bike and tie my shoes, could no longer see me. He wasn't my protector anymore. He was just another person who had let me down, another person who had turned their back when I needed them most. I glanced at the calendar on the wall, just 2 days until my birthday, circled in bright red marker. March 3rd, my birthday. That night, as I lay in bed, staring up at the ceiling, I prayed to God. "If I'm supposed to leave this situation, I need the clearest answer from you I've ever gotten in my life. I need you to help me know that I'm done with this. Please, God, give me a sign." The next morning, I woke with a start, tears streaming down my face. 3 words rang through my mind, as clear as if they'd been spoken aloud. "It ends now." And that was all I needed. With shaking hands, I grabbed my phone and started composing a message to my bishop. I knew what I had to do, knew what the church expected of me, but the thought of laying bare my deepest shame, my darkest secrets. I closed my eyes, taking a deep breath, Heavenly Father, I whispered, my voice cracking, please give me strength. Give me courage. And then I began to type. Bishop, I need to speak with you. I've done something bad, and I have to confess. By the time I hit send, my face was streaked with tears. I was essentially sealing my fate. I'm going to get kicked out of the church, I thought, my heart racing. But I had to do this. I couldn't keep this inside anymore. I was willing to face whatever church discipline I needed if it meant making things right and living my life with a clear conscience. Next, I messaged my Aunt Julie. Hey, I really need to talk to you guys about something. Her response was immediate. Sure, come over. I left my phone at my apartment, not wanting to risk Derek seeing where I was going. I found myself in my aunt and uncle's living room, my eyes fixed on the carpet as I tried to find the words to tell my story. It came out in bits and pieces. I didn't tell them all the details, but I think they understood. You poor thing, Julie said, pulling me into a tight hug. I want you to know, we support you no matter what, Sherry. I went back to my apartment to pick up my phone, immediately returning to my aunt's house because I didn't want to be alone. I saw a barrage of texts from Derek, as usual. But that day, I couldn't bring myself to text him back right away. In fact, I waited as long as I could, the longest I'd ever gone without responding to him. Sherry, what is going on? Are you okay? He wrote in his 100th text of the day. I caved and responded, just to shut him up. Nothing is wrong. I'm spending the day at my aunt's house, I replied. Which aunt? My Aunt Julie in Provo. But your phone showed you at your apartment all day. I forgot to bring it with me. That's why I didn't respond to you until now. You never leave your phone behind. You're upset about something. I can tell. Derek, I'm fine. You're sad because it's your birthday, aren't you? You're sad that you don't have your family to celebrate with. It's okay. I'm here, Sherry. You won't be alone on your birthday. I'll make it special for you. I'll take you to dinner. I couldn't bring myself to respond. Less than 30 minutes later, I saw Derek's car pull into the street from my aunt's big living room window. I couldn't believe it. He'd used the location sharing function on my phone to track me down. I scrambled into the corner, trying to make myself as small as possible. He's here, I gasped. We all watched, frozen, as he pulled up next to my car, parked and got out, his arms laden with gifts. He left them by my car before finally driving away, his expression dark. Aunt Julie stared, aghast, at this nearly 50-year-old man acting like some lovesick Santa Claus. How dare he? Julie whispered. He's old enough to be your father. A married man chasing after my niece? I'm so sorry. I never meant to. Julie shook her head vehemently. Sherry, it's not your fault. That guy is completely nuts. Look at him. Do you want us to talk to him? No, I said. I'll end it myself. I'll message him later. It has to be me. Otherwise, he won't believe it. At night, I went back to my apartment and found myself on the living room couch, sobbing uncontrollably. I wasn't even trying to hide my distress from my roomies anymore. Sherry, what happened? Asked my conservative roommate. I couldn't believe that this person, among the most religiously conforming girls I knew, was about to be the first person I'd ever fully confide in about this. But that's what happened. Through my tears, I told her everything. That there was a married man, much older than me. That I had done things with him, very intimate things. That I had never wanted to do, but did anyway. That I was a fornicator, an adulteress, a sinner. All the secrets I'd kept hidden for the past 2 years. To my surprise, instead of judgment, I saw only compassion in her eyes. She hugged me tightly and said, I'm so sorry this happened to you, Sherry. I don't know who this man is, but he sounds like a demon. But I was complicit. I didn't stop it. I'm going to confess everything to my bishop. I watched her eyes widen. I'm probably going to get my temple recommend taken away, I added. No, Sherry. She shook her head, terrified. A temple recommend is the document that certifies you're worthy to enter and participate in temple ceremonies. If you engage in serious sin, though, it can be revoked. It would be a source of great shame to me if that happened. It would distance me from God. It was the worst-case scenario. My roommate stood up and started pacing. No, you cannot lose your temple recommend. That wouldn't be right. This isn't your fault. My other roommate came in, and I explained what was going on. Sherry, what are you going to do? She asked in shock. End it. But he's going to be very upset when I do, So from now on, we have to be extra cautious. We need to keep doors closed, blinds drawn, and everything locked. They nodded, looking scared. Then I took a deep breath and stood up, my phone in my hand. It's time. I'll do it in private, if that's okay. I went into my bedroom and sat on the bed with trembling fingers. I typed out the message, my heart pounding. Derek, I'm done. It's over. I want you to leave me alone, forever. My finger hovered over the send button, my heart pounding against my ribcage. He wouldn't let me go easily, but I couldn't keep living like this. I hit send. His response was swift and cold. Wow, Sherry. Well, I guess I was right. You never did care about me. You're a liar. That's not true. I did care. But this is wrong, and I'm just not okay with where this has ended up. It has to stop. Do not contact me ever again. Fine, Sherry, he responded. Have a good life. I blocked his phone number and stared at my phone for what felt like hours before hearing a soft knock on the door. Can we come in? Yes. My roommates came in and sat with me quietly. Sherry, isn't it your birthday? One asked. I nodded. Yeah. We should get stuff to make pizzas and watch a movie, said the other brightly. No one should be allowed to ruin this day. Their kindness and understanding meant more to me than they'll ever know. The next day, my bishop and I had a Zoom call. I was going to confess. The Zoom window flickered to life, revealing Bishop Johnson's concerned face. I took a deep breath, my hands shaking slightly as I adjusted my laptop screen. Sherry, I'm glad you reached out. What's troubling you? His voice was gentle, encouraging. I swallowed hard. I don't even know where to start. Take your time, he said softly. Remember, we're here to help you find peace. Tears welled up in my eyes as I struggled to find the words. I got involved with someone, a married man, Derek, and things happened that shouldn't have. It's all my fault. I knew better, but I still... The bishop listened intently, his brow furrowed with concern. When I finished, he leaned closer to the camera. Sherry, I want you to listen to me very carefully. You were put in a situation no young person should have to face. I burst into tears. For the first time, I felt a glimmer of understanding that maybe, just maybe, I wasn't entirely to blame. Bishop Johnson's voice was gentle, but his eyes were serious. Normally, in a situation like this, the minimum level of church discipline is losing your temple recommend, he said, his brow furrowed. I know. I'm ready to accept whatever punishment I deserve. Bishop Johnson held up a hand, shaking his head. Hold on, Sherry. I'm not sure punishment is what you need right now. Thank you, Bishop. I know that. Ultimately, it's not up to me to decide what course of action the church wishes to take. I'll have to give the stake president a call and discuss these allegations. The stake president was one level higher in the hierarchy and would give my bishop instructions on what to do. A couple of days went by, each minute feeling like an eternity. When my phone finally rang, showing my bishop's number, I jumped, desperate to hear what he had to say. So, I talked it over with the stake president, he said, his tone measured. He reminded me that we do have a responsibility to ensure that our members are living in accordance with God's laws. He thinks it's best if you take a break from the temple for a bit and hold off on taking the sacrament for a little while we investigate. I'm sorry, Sherry. So I'm losing my temple recommend, I confirmed, a bitter taste in my mouth. For now, yes, I'm afraid so. I felt a flicker of anger, hot and sharp in my chest. And what about Derek? What's going to happen to him? Will he lose his temple recommend too? It's not up to me. I'm going to need his full name and address so that I can reach out to his bishop. I'll let you know what course of action they decide to take. I understand, I said. I'll pray for you, Sherry. Thank you, Bishop. There was nothing more I could say or do. The nightmare was over. At least, I thought it was, until the email started. Sherry, I'm so sorry. I've deeply hurt you. I hope you can forgive me someday. I just like things to end on a better note. We should talk. I blocked Derek's email address, but he just created a new one, sending me more messages, begging to see me. Sherry, you can't do this. I need you. And you need me. Don't do this. Text messages started coming from his son's number. His son was on an LDS mission abroad at the time. an incessant, never-ending stream of manipulation and guilt-tripping. One day, I saw his truck drive by my apartment building, circling the block, and that's when I got really scared. My roommates and I huddled in the living room, curtains drawn, one of them peeking out to make sure he was gone before any of us dared to leave the apartment. Eventually, the texts, emails, and the drive-bys stopped, but I remained hypervigilant, always on high alert, always looking over my shoulder, always double-checking the locks, worried he was going to show up and take me. Derek received no disciplinary action whatsoever. He denied everything, and his bishop believed him without question. He was high up in the church, after all. Who would take my word over his? It didn't help that I deleted all his texts and emails. There was no proof. But still, it didn't make sense to me. If they really believed nothing had ever happened, why had they taken away my temple recommend? If I was a fornicator, then so was he. It takes two to tango, as they say. After a month, the stake president agreed to give me my temple recommend back. But it still didn't undo the fact that I'd been made to feel like this was all my fault. My bishop advised me not to be upset, to just put it behind me. But how could I? I lost all trust and faith. Not in God, but in these men who, when faced with a young woman's pain, decided to brush it under the carpet and protect their friend. In the end, I decided to change my ward, to start fresh with a new bishop and a new community. It would mean worshiping with a different congregation, with strangers. But that was okay. My Heavenly Father knew the depths of my heart and the strength of my spirit. From now on, in Him alone would I place my trust, and no one else. Chapter 42, True Crimes. In the spring of 2023, I finally broke the news to Kevin's parents about the family's disintegration. Grandpa Frankie was in his late 80s, and Grandma Frankie was nearing 80, and they were woefully out of touch with the digital world, where much of our family drama played out. No social media, barely able to operate their iPhones, they were relics of a different era, and, until that day, blissfully unaware of the complexities of our modern family crisis. Grandma greeted me at the door, her face lighting up. "Sherry, what a lovely surprise. Come in, come in. You want some ice cream?" As we sat around their worn kitchen table, the weight of what I had to say pressed down on me. "So, how's everyone doing?" Grandma said, her eyes hopeful. "We haven't heard from Kevin in such a long while. He must be very busy with work." I took a deep breath. "Well, that's why I'm here. There's something you need to know." As I explained the situation, Kevin moving out, Ruby taking the kids, my estrangement, I watched their expressions shift from confusion to heartbreak. Grandpa's weathered hand trembled as he set down his mug. "I don't understand. Kevin left Ruby?" "She told him to leave." Grandma's voice quavered. "And the children? Where are they?" "I don't know, Grandma. No one's seen them for months. Ruby's gotten involved with this group. They have some strange ideas about family and parenting. She's cut off contact with a lot of people, including me, and her parents and sisters." "That doesn't sound like Ruby at all. She loves her mother," Grandma protested weakly. "Yeah, I guess she changed her mind." The silence that followed was deafening. "Don't worry, Grandma," I said. "I'm working with social services, and we're going to make sure the kids are okay. I'll keep you updated on things. I'm sure everything will get figured out soon." "You're a good girl, Sherry," said my grandfather, his voice wavering. Weeks later, during another visit, Grandma cornered me in the kitchen, her voice hushed. "Sherry, dear, have you heard anything from Kevin or any of the children? We're just so worried." I felt a pang of frustration mixed with sympathy. "Grandma, I'm sorry. I don't know anything new. The second I find out anything, you'll be the first to know." "But surely there must be." I cut her off as gently as I could. "Grandma, please, if I know anything, I promise I'll tell you. But asking all the time, it doesn't help. It just hurts us both." She nodded, tears welling up. "I'm sorry, dear. I feel so helpless." I hugged her then, feeling the fragility of her frame, the weight of her worry. Throughout the spring and summer of 2023, I remained stuck in a nightmarish loop. My calls to the police and DCFS were getting us nowhere, thanks to Utah's free-range parenting law. Passed in 2018, the law was intended to protect parents who allow their children more independence, but it was absolutely sabotaging anyone's ability to protect my siblings. On the surface, this legislation seemed like a breath of fresh air for parents who believe in fostering independence in their children. The law essentially redefined neglect, making it clear that allowing kids to engage in independent activities, like walking to school alone, playing outside unsupervised, or staying home by themselves, isn't inherently neglectful. But the law's vague language was open to interpretation that could potentially be exploited by those looking to justify genuine neglect or even abuse. Worst of all, it heavily impacted the ability of child welfare agencies to respond to complaints of neglect. Faced with the fear of violating this new legislation, social workers and other professionals found that their hands were tied when asked to intervene in situations, even when it was clear that children were genuinely at risk, with potentially devastating consequences for vulnerable kids who desperately need help, like my siblings. Even the disturbing videos Ruby and Jody kept posting in their connections classroom weren't seen as cause enough to justify an intervention. They continued spouting their increasingly alarming ideas that adults can force children to do whatever they want, that children have no right to privacy or autonomy, that medication is a sign of living in distortion. They railed against social media, claiming it was corrupting children and turning them gay, while asserting that being gay was a sin and a choice. They argued that phones were more dangerous than guns and that school shootings were simply a result of people being disconnected. In just one episode, Truthful Touch, Ruby unleashed a barrage of alarming statements, offering a disturbing window into her unhinged mindset. Most chillingly, she declared, "If your child comes to you on fire, you don't pat them on the head and say, 'It's okay, I'll help you.' No, you beat them and you kick them and you hit them with a rod. You cannot put welts on your child's legs and then lovingly apply gauze and expect healing." This statement sent shivers down my spine. Welts? Was this a hypothetical scenario or an admission? The casual way she spoke about inflicting harm on a child made my skin crawl. It wasn't just the words themselves, but the matter-of-fact tone, as if discussing something as mundane as making breakfast. I knew how harsh Ruby could be when it came to child discipline, but this felt different. This felt like sadism. My mind raced down dark pathways. The image of my younger siblings, vulnerable and at the mercy of someone capable of such thoughts, was haunting me, and every day that passed with Ruby having custody felt like watching a countdown to disaster. How long before her rhetoric might transform into irreparable harm, if it hadn't already? Even with all of this disturbing content out there on the internet, accessible to anyone with a web browser, legally, there was nothing we could do to extract the children from her custody, thanks to that free-range parenting law. The system designed to protect the vulnerable was failing spectacularly, leaving my siblings trapped in what I feared was a nightmare come to life. How could something so glaringly wrong be allowed to continue? And where the hell was Kevin? In June 2023, news reached me that Kevin had abruptly abandoned his professor position at BYU. A pang of sadness hit me. His contributions in the field of geotechnical earthquake research could have saved countless lives in seismic zones around the world. But a bitter irony struck me. Here was a man who dedicated his life to protecting people, yet remained paralyzed in the face of the catastrophe unfolding in his own family. What would it take for Kevin to redirect even a fraction of the energy he'd poured into his research toward safeguarding his own flesh and blood? I wished Kevin could somehow find the strength to stand up and fight against the real dangers that loomed over us, the most pressing being Ruby, the woman who had full, unchecked custody of my siblings, the same woman who brazenly discussed putting welts on kids' legs as if it were a normal parenting technique. Forget earthquakes, Kevin. The ground beneath our feet was already crumbling. Journal. Tomorrow, it will have been a year since Dad was invited to leave. It also happens to be Pioneer Day. In a way, I feel like I'm a pioneer for myself and family. I'm breaking generations of abuse and evil. I will be better to my kids than my parents ever were to theirs. On top of everything else that was happening, I was scrambling to find a place to live. The lease on my shared two-bedroom apartment was ending, and obviously, I couldn't go back home to Springville. I'd lined up a one-bedroom apartment off campus in Provo and was supposed to move in over the summer. Just me, all alone. The problem was that Derek had co-signed the lease months before I'd cut him out of my life. I didn't really get what co-signing meant back then. I had no credit or rental history, so when the landlord said I needed a co-signer, I was stuck. My parents weren't talking to me, so Derek had stepped in, offering to co-sign. It felt like he was helping me out, but looking back, I can see it was just another way for him to maintain control over me. After cutting things off with Derek, I knew I had to get out of that lease. I wanted, no, I needed, to go somewhere he wouldn't know about, somewhere I could feel safe. I found myself on the phone with the landlord, trying to figure out how to cancel the contract. Luckily, he understood my situation and canceled the lease. But that left me with a new problem. I had to find another place to live before my junior year started. It was stressful, searching for a new home with time running out. It wasn't until mid-August that I finally found a solution. Some BYU students had an extra room in their apartment in Provo, and thankfully, with days before the semester started, I moved myself and my few possessions in there. As I unpacked my stuff in my new room, I felt both safe and unsure. Derek didn't know where I was now, which was a huge weight off my shoulders. But I also felt lost, drowning in the unending chaos of my life, facing the question of how to juggle a new semester of school with the ongoing drama in my family. The past year had tested me in ways I never imagined possible. I felt bent, nearly broken, by the forces tearing my family apart. And yet, here I was, still clinging to hope with a desperation that surprised even me. Whatever was coming, good or bad, triumph or tragedy, I would face it head on. Journal. I get the feeling something is going to happen with my family soon. I can't tell if it will be good or bad, but I feel it will be big. But I refuse to believe, after everything I've gone through in the past year, that I won't be given an opportunity to help my family be together again. I will do whatever God wants from me in order to achieve that. Shortly after moving into my new shared apartment, I sat with my new roommates in the living room, watching a true crime documentary, Sins of Our Mother. It was about an LDS couple, Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. They had gotten married super fast after both their spouses died under sketchy circumstances. Chad's former wife, Tammy Daybell, died in October 2019 under suspicious circumstances, and Lori's former husband, Charles Vallow, was shot and killed by Lori's brother in July 2019. In September 2019, Lori's two children, Tylee Ryan, 16, and Joshua J.J. Vallow, 7, were reported missing. Lori and Chad married in November 2019, just weeks after Tammy Daybell's death, and while their kids were still missing. The couple were immersed in the same extreme religious beliefs and doomsday preparations as Jody and Ruby, and the way this family spiraled into darkness felt horribly familiar. Their intense belief in the Second Coming and their obsession with Tom Harrison's Visions of Glory prophecies, it was all the same stuff Ruby and Jody were always going on about. But it wasn't until watching that documentary that my hope faded into the darkest thoughts I'd had yet. Ruby and Jody were just as unhinged as Chad and Lori, if not worse. If we don't do something soon, my siblings are going to die. Thank goodness for our Springville neighbors, my loyal allies in this fight. They were right there with me, leaving food on the doorstep of our house in case the kids were hungry, making call after call to DCFS, voicing their concerns about the kids being left alone for days on end when Ruby went to Ivan's to see Jody, leaving them without proper food or care. But even as the hurdles kept piling up, I could feel a shift inside myself. Through therapy, meds, and a whole lot of hard work, I was getting stronger, better equipped to handle the emotional storms that had once threatened to drown me. Derek was no longer in my life. The fog of shame and self-blame was starting to lift, replaced by a new sense of clarity and purpose. For years, I'd been pulled in two directions. One voice commanded me to be the perfect, obedient daughter, putting my faith in supposed authorities. But another voice demanded that this time I think for myself. that I had the courage to disobey anyone or anything that tried to dehumanize me or those I love. Not mindless submission, but faithfulness to my own inner truth, faithfulness to the divinity and sovereign worth of my God-given life on this earth. Armed with this newfound strength, I doubled down on my efforts to come up with a plan to save my siblings. I'd be damned if I let them become another cautionary tale. I kept calling DCFS, kept studying the law surrounding child abuse, kept searching for legal avenues to save my siblings. I kept trying until that phone call from my neighbor on August 30th, 2023. It was a Wednesday, and for as long as I live, I'll never forget hearing my neighbor's words. "Sherry, the police are at your mother's house." Chapter 43, The House of My Mother. I stood paralyzed on the front lawn, my breath shallow, my hands shaking. The red and blue lights of the squad cars strobed as I stood in front of my house, frozen. Ruby's white 8-passengers van sat in the driveway like a beached whale, gleaming under the pulsing lights. "Please, God, let the children be okay," I prayed silently, my heart in my throat. Crack! They slammed the battering ram into the door so hard I jumped. Wood splinters flew everywhere. "Police! Everyone out! Now!"